Hello, everyone and everybody. Welcome back to another edition of the Mundane Festival Podcast. I'm your host, Chris Lambert. Today is Saturday, October 31st, 2020. Remember, as always, you can subscribe to the show on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Spotify, Google Podcasts, and even Podbean, the host site. If you like this show, please rate and review it on Apple Podcasts. Give it a 5-star review. Let everybody know why you like it, because it will make me feel good about myself and most of the life decisions that I've made so far. You can email the show at mundanefestivalpod@gmail.com. Let me know what's on your mind. More importantly, what's on your heart. You can like the show on Facebook. You can follow it on Twitter at Mundane Festival. And you can follow me, your host, the guy talking to you right now, on Twitter at Chris Lambert. This is episode 462. I have a super special guest, comedian and Emmy Award-winning television writer, Brian Parisi. He's got a new album out called Last Wishes. It's coming out on Election Day. Right about now, you should have already cast your early ballot. You should have done early voting. If you haven't, I hope you're doing that. November 3rd is the last day. It's not the first day. It's the last day to cast your vote. I hope that you're doing that. I hope you're not like Ice Cube or Lil Wayne, or even thinking you can beat the coronavirus by drinking tea or some shit like T.I. I mean, I don't know what's going on with these rappers, guys. I'm going to share my conversation that I had with Brian with you in a bit. Yeah, I don't know what's going on with these rappers. Happy Halloween, everybody. Happy Halloween. Hey, be safe. You shouldn't be partying. Maybe party in your pod of people that you hang out with, I guess. I hope that you're safe. I think people will use any excuse to hang out and do shit that you probably shouldn't be doing in this pandemic. Just be safe. Wear your mask. Wear a mask over your mask. You know, if you're going to be a sexy nurse, make sure that sexy nurse has a mask on. If you're going to be a sexy nun, wear a mask over that sexy nun. Sexy Wolverine, make sure that sexy Wolverine monster is wearing a mask. Just do that. You know, let's be safe. What's going on? College football's on. Clemson is playing Boston College, and Clemson star quarterback Trevor Lawrence is out because he has the Rona, and they don't give a shit because they're still playing. There's actually people in the audience and in the audience, like in the crowd, people in the stands. That's a lot of people. Shit. They're not, it's not as packed, but it's still, oh, it's in South Carolina. So, hope that everybody voted. I voted a couple weeks ago. It's going to be an interesting few days. I'll leave it at that. I don't know it's going to be interesting. At least if things go wrong, we have Brian Parisi's album, Last Wishes, to make you laugh. And we have Busta Rhymes' new album, Extinction Level Event 2, The Wrath of God, when we hit the streets to riot. So it's either going to go one or two ways. You're either going to be, you should listen to Busta Rhymes because he's at the top of his game. And I think with this album, he cemented himself as one of the greats. I mean, I always thought that he was a great MC, and I had my heart, goes out to him because he's a part of my childhood, a big part of my childhood as far as music is concerned, and just a dude that stood the test of time. And it could have easily been a clunker, but it wasn't. And yeah, man, it was really good. Like, I was listening to it, I thought people were just kind of speaking in hyperbole, because I wake up early in the morning. People are, oh, this new Busta, it's good. This new Busta, blah, blah, blah. People just talking about this new Busta Rhymes album. And I'm like, okay, guys. All right, guys. I guess I'll listen to it, okay? I mean, come on. You know, because Common came out, and we'll get, you know, I'm not, yeah, Common came out. Quite a few people came out, and I'll talk about that more on Patreon. But Busta Rhymes, I was like, okay, let me, because normally I like to listen to my podcast while I'm working from home and doing my TPS reports. And but I was like, I got to, people are tweeting about this. This is early in the morning. People are steadily tweeting about Busta Rhymes. And I listened to it, and I'm like, wow, this dude, it was a huge nostalgia trip. It was, and it made me feel good. Like, that's cool. And, but it was just still timely as well. So it wasn't like he wasn't pandering to the past, or he was just like, the album is very of the times, of the moment. It's very relevant, and the rhymes are great. The production's great. The guest appearances, it was so amazing to hear him and Q-Tip together on a record. Him and Mariah Carey, him and Mary J. Blige. It was just like, yo, this is, it really made me feel old. I posted on Twitter a notification that I got from Google. Google was like, Busta Rhymes' new album is out. We know you're black and you're 40. So you are going to like this shit. You know, that's when they got the algorithm. That's one of those times where they got the algorithm right. But my God, wire to wire excellence. Wire to wire, 21 tracks. It's like an hour and 17 minutes long. There's interludes, and it's just like, wow, okay. And there's some Michael Jackson samples. It's like, how much did he have to pay Berry Gordy for that, you know? Really good, really impressive, man. Because I was talking about Busta Rhymes like a couple of months ago, just like, what do you think his best album? I mean, it's like, damn, is this shit his best album? And I saw on Twitter where, either Twitter or Instagram, where Ninth Wonder posted something about like, yeah, you know, I guess he did work on a record, because I know at least one, because Rhapsody's on a rhyming with him. Really good song. He knows how to stick to a theme, and he knows how to tell a fucking story. They both kind of tell a story being like parents, like basically being baby mamas and baby daddies. And they, you know, talking about their relationship, and they still want to raise their kid and all that. Really good shit, man. Just like fucking great. And he was just talking about how he kind of, I guess they had been working on it for 2 years, this ELE 2, but fantastic project. Also a fantastic project, Brian Parisi's Last Wishes. I've known Brian for a few years. We're trying to figure out where we met. Probably met him in DC. And obviously he's here in New York, the New York area, working and doing his thing. Just always just been a dude that was super funny. And I did not know him super well, but just always somebody who I respected. And he reached out about coming on and shooting the shit and talking about this album. And it's really good. Like, he's just very, I just love the he's super funny, but I just really appreciate, the technical aspect of his, you know, me being a comedy nerd, like the technical way that he delivers his jokes. And I forgot to tell him this, and I hope if he re-listens to this, he'll hear this. There are some moments, like when he was doing his act outs. Fuck, I forget. Just got done talking to him, and I forgot to mention this. He kind of sounded like Sam Kennedy, slightly. I'm not saying he was. I'm not saying he. It was reminiscent of the way like his yell outs or his. It wasn't like full on. Oh. It wasn't like that, but it just reminded me like of a burst. And I don't know if that's because I've been watching that comedy. That Comedy Store documentary on Showtime. Maybe it could be, but he was a Sam Kinison was a well-respected OG, and it was a little reminiscent of that. There's some parts, just a slight thing. It was not like shit. I got into a fucking rabbit hole talking about this, but it just Brian writes his own original jokes. They're fucking brilliant. You should listen to it. Hopefully you won't be needing it to make you feel better after what may or may not happen on November 3rd, but you will just be listening to it because it's funny and he's a talented dude. So without further ado, here's my conversation with the very funny and the very talented Brian Parisi. So how have things been going for you this year? Is it a wash for you or what?
A wash is probably kind. yeah, it's been like it's been a harsh wash. It's been a pressure wash. Yeah, so when it started out, I was like, I got out of New York for a couple of months and I was like living in South Carolina and then I came back. So I've been back now for a while. But yeah, it's just been, a lot of weird firsts where you don't like, I haven't seen my family that much. Like it's just, all the things that everybody's dealing with have definitely gotten to me. And I sort of have like an anxiety thing. So that's not the, it's not the best quality to have during all this.
Yeah, I guess I understand that because I think it's getting towards the end of the year and it's holidays and it's usually the dread to go home sometimes, but still wanting to go home, but just not wanting to deal with certain bullshit. But then it's like I kind of still want to go home, you know?
Yeah. I mean, I'm like very afraid of killing my parents.
Yeah. Yeah.
And like, it's, like if one of my other brothers wants to kill my parents, like that's fine. But I just don't.
Yeah.
I don't want to be the one to do it. You know what I mean?
Right. I don't want that hanging over my head. And my dad basically said, and not to come home and without saying it. And, I told, I'm going to get supposedly be getting a new phone, like an iPhone. I've been a Android user all my life, but when I say all my life, it's like 2014. but it's
since I was a young boy, I dreamed of a design that didn't exist.
Yeah, since I was a 34-year-old, I've been using Android because I had BlackBerry previously, and. And my mom got an iPad, so I said, we could do FaceTime if I got an iPhone. But then I think that's opening up another ball of wax that maybe it's not a ball of wax, but just Pandora's box of them getting the FaceTiming. But I just said, you know what? The iPhone 12 Pro Max looks sexy. Why not? I'll give it a go and see what happens and do FaceTime with them. But yeah, it's hard. Like I turned down a gig that I normally like to do, like a stand-up gig. It just doesn't seem safe to me, you know.
Was it an indoor gig?
Yeah, indoor casino gig, and I was just like, man. I was like, I'd love to do it. Love to have the money. It's good money, but the booker understands, so he's not like, well, fuck you.
right.
Have you had to turn anything down recently, or?
I honestly have not been pursuing anything indoors yet. I've just been getting booked on outdoor stuff. And, that worked well for when it was, I think we're right at the point of the year where, like, now I'm going to have to ask my, like, figure that out of, am I going to do things indoors? Because, the weather's changing. But so to this point, I've been able to, get enough stuff doing outdoor, not making a ton of money, obviously, because it's trash. But but at least being able to, like, try new stuff and write and, keep the process going.
Right.
So, but, it's pretty soon, I think it's going to be like, all right, like, I think there are indoor gigs I would feel okay doing. I know there's some places that, like, are just these huge, like, if it's a big place that's 25% full, I feel like, and people are, kind of spread out, that feels like it's probably fine to me.
Yeah.
I know there are some gigs like that, that I might try to do. I want to avoid being sort of like packed in close to a lot of people. It just feels kind of like it's a bad call.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, otherwise I think I would be, I've seen like a lot of my friends on Instagram doing shows just like it's nothing. And it's just like, okay. It's like, and for the most part, I think nothing's going to happen, but it just, we don't have a vaccine yet. So I'm just kind of like, I can hold off for a little bit. I've, I've put in 11 years, and I think when the time comes for me to come back, I'll be ready, even though I miss it and stuff. But I think I would want to be working towards something, and you know, and having that in mind, where it's just like it's just stagnant. Like it's just like different. You may not get a gig in 2 months, but then in, you know, I don't know. It's just all fucked up.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't envy people who are, you know, having to make, you know, they're just hard choices. It's mm-hmm. like, you know, especially when it's your livelihood, it's like,
yeah.
So, yeah, it's not a great type of stand-up, but I feel like one thing that's been cool, you know, being in New York and doing all this, and I've done them in other places too, because I bought a car when all this happened, so I could like get around without having to get near people.
Sure.
Doing this stuff, it's like, it's just cool how much of like cockroaches we are. You can't kill comics. Like there's so many like little things, like, you know, just shit popping up in alleys. Like we are the rats of the earth, and I fucking love it. and so that's been really fun to just like, you know, to see how it just like kind of keeps going. And I know it's not, you know, I don't want to pretend, I feel like it's sort of wrong to pretend like it's the same because of the reasons we're talking about, because some people are literally like struggling to you know, to make things work, so it's definitely not the same, but it's also like, it's not, you know, it's surviving as a thing, which I like. You know, I think there's certain things that like are not doing that. Mm-hmm. You know, like Broadway, like stuff like that. It's just like flat out not happening, it seems like.
Yeah.
I'm not in that world. Maybe there's like show tunes and shit popping up in backyards. I don't know.
Well, my listeners know this, but I was working on a Broadway show. I had a small part on a Broadway show before the shutdown. We were in previews, and yeah, it was like I was about to make my Broadway debut. Technically, I made it. I'm going to count it, but it's just like, it was like, ah, fuck, you know, it was like,
oh, wow.
Yeah. So I heard June, I heard two things yesterday. I heard June, then I heard September of next year.
They have no idea, my friend.
Yeah. One of my friends who's in.
Yeah.
I have a friend in the in like another union in the theater. And she was saying like, possibly, September, because I said I think I heard June, and then she said, well, I heard September, and I was like, well, you know what, September probably sounds the most the best, you know.
Yeah, the thing that's weird to me is this sort of this wild card of just like every once in a while at the end of a conversation about when things are going to come back, there's some scientist in the corner who's like, oh by the way, this might kind of like mutate and come back every year as a thing.
Yeah.
Like, and I'm like, oh my God. Like, you know, there's that thing of just like that unknown of when we do the vaccine and like do this thing, I you know, I think it'll be much, much better. But I wonder if this will be a thing that there are some people thinking this will be a thing that we are actually dealing with for years to come after, you know, that the vaccine sort of restores normalcy. Is, you know, will we be battling this like it's, you know, like a killer flu every year? I don't know. Like, I don't know enough to say whether what's going on, but just the fact that that's floating out there to me means that any timeline we set for this is pretty, I don't know.
Yeah, no, I can believe that too. I mean, that is very plausible, because it's just like, yeah, you don't know what's going to happen. I mean, my favorite video game is the Last of Us, and it's about a fungus that mutates and wipes out a lot of society. And you know, obviously there's zombie shit going on in the game, but that it just makes me think about that shit.
Yeah.
And it's pretty bad. And I'm not going to speak for you, but my capitalist lizard, artistic, selfish brain is like, well, when is this shit coming back?
Yeah,
you know, I want stuff to come back, and I get bummed out, a little angry, but then at the same time, it's just like, well, I'm gonna do what I'm supposed to do. Like, I'm gonna wear my mask, I'm gonna, you know, keep my distance, and, you know, try to earn a living doing my day job. But you know, other people don't have that choice. But it's almost like when people are doing stand up, it's kind of like, well, are you getting something out of it? Are you getting paid? Or like, are some of these comics, our friends, still getting jerked around by, you know, shitty promoters and bookers? Or are they just, you know, taking the reins? So I see some people, you know, kind of making, making profits out of it, you know, yeah. doing like on some DIY type shit, you know?
Yeah. I mean, I've been getting paid. I it's not a lot of money, but I've been getting paid, to do gigs, that honestly, I feel like before the pandemic might've been not paid gigs.
Mm.
I think there's a sense of, everybody knows, like, this is not an easy time for anyone. And so, and it's not an easy time for people who are booking either.
Right, right.
If anything, I feel like there is a little bit, this is just my experience, but I think there's some sense of, like, we've always been in this together with bookers, but, like, it's almost like a little more. It's like now we're both going through the same thing.
Right.
You know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
I wonder if this might actually sort of, in the long run, help a little bit, because we're seeing that, like, oh, we are tied together, and we, you know, one doesn't work without the other. I hope that there's some of that, because I feel that for when I see clubs, like, struggling, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
It's like, I hope they stay open. Like, we really are an ecosystem that relies on each other.
Definitely, yeah. And I know, like, detractors will say, well, fuck them, they never booked me. I mean,
those people are trash, though. You know what I mean?
But it's like,
no, look, I don't get, you know, like, I just, the thing is, like, if people don't book you, like, it doesn't mean you're bad. Like, people right. take it very personally. I've been one of those people that's taken personally, for mm-hmm. sure. But I just can't imagine going to the level of, like, actually actively, you know what I mean? Some people come up with, like, vendettas about this stuff. And I'm just like, yo, just, you gotta, you know, it's like, you gotta move on. Like, at best, they probably, like, a lot of times they probably just don't know about you, or they're too full,
right?
Or you suck. Those are the only, you know, like, rational possibilities. So, like, what do you complain about?
Yeah, I've gotten like that in the past, and you know, before all this, but I don't want to see people lose stuff, you know, because there's servers, there's security, there's wait, you know, there's staff and management and all that. There's people that are losing their jobs, and it I think you hit the nail on the head. It's an ecosystem that we all need each other, you know?
Yeah.
And it kind of, well, I think I've always appreciated, whenever I got to do a show, I think starting in I started when I was 29, so I was an older guy, but, like, it was just kind of, I just always appreciate it. And especially when you get paid, like, when, it's like, I always just appreciated this, that club atmosphere. I think it's really, to me, it's nothing like it. Like, it's nothing like that live performance. And
yeah,
I was talking to, JL Covan a couple weeks ago, and I was telling him about this new Steve Byrne movie, the opening act, where it's basically like, Steve Byrne's life, like, coming up as a comic, but Jimmy O Yang plays a version of him, and it's good. Like, it's just about a comic who gets his first weekend hosting at an improv, like, at a club, you know.
Huh.
And it's like, really, like, I was like, yeah, I feel that shit, you know. Like, on the surface, it's just kind of, you could kind of, some people could kind of look at that as like a throwaway movie, but it's, to me, it's like really rich. Probably, I would say it might end up on my end of the year list, Brian.
Oh, okay.
I would say, but it's a it's a good movie, and it's for those feelings that it evokes. It's definitely like, yeah, man, this fucking movie is great. But
I'll have to check that out. That's very inside. Like, that's
yeah.
it's an experience that I've had that I think is, like, a cool experience.
Yeah.
Like, to me, it's something I would never think to tell other people about.
Yeah.
But, you know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
It's very inside comedy, but I would watch that for sure.
Yeah, yeah. It's definitely, like, I remember when I first started, like, I started in 2009, and I remember a couple years, maybe a year or two after I started, Funny People came out, and people were, you know, people had mixed feelings about it, but that stand-up shit, like, that was that was pretty, that was on the money. I mean,
yeah, it was pretty real. Yeah.
Yeah. Because Apatow was a stand up and Sandler is a stand up, you know, and it's, and, you know, it just had, it had the dramatic side with the, with the, with his girl, like ex and all that stuff. But I, yeah. I really dug that. It's in my Blu-ray collection, you know.
I think I enjoyed that movie. I felt always, I felt like there was like maybe 25 minutes of it I didn't need or
yeah.
so. Well, I often feel like that with his movies. But, yeah. but I like them a lot. I always just feel like, I can't quite tell what it is, but it just feels like long to me.
No,
but,
it's his that movies.
That movie was like, yeah. Sorry, go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, yeah, I was just agreeing with you. His movies can sometimes feel bloated at times, but if you really, if you're into the character, it's like, who gives a shit, you know?
Totally.
Like Lord of the Rings, they could have cut some shit.
definitely. Honestly, I remember what they could have cut. There was this a long part with these trees that were talking, and I was like, I don't. If I was watching this movie, it's just, you know, if you're a book nerd,
yeah,
I shouldn't say book nerd. It sounds very, I sound like a bully from Massachusetts, but this is.
And we'll get into that. We'll get into that in a bit.
If you're a Lord of the Ring person, I think, and I was like, yeah, maybe, you know, let's cut these trees. You'd be like, what?
Yeah,
like, you know, you'd be like, this is a critical, like. But if you're just a person who's watching a movie and you're not into that, you're like, oh, man, back to the trees again?
They
talk slow. Saying are boring. I'm like, guys, can we make the trees talk a little faster since they're so boring?
Yeah, yeah. What was that? Was that in the last one, Return of the King?
I think it was in the last one. They might have honestly been in two. I'll tell you what, if they were in one movie, it felt like they were in two.
I was in grad school when I went to grad school for theater, and there were nerds, you know, so they, one night, midnight, they dragged me to that fucking movie. And it was long, dude. It was just, and like, it's happened, and that was, I guess that was payback for me taking one of my best friends who's not in the show business at all. I made him go see Magnolia with me when we were on college break. That's a Paul Thomas Anderson movie that's like 3 hours long.
Yeah.
And those, have you seen it?
I have not seen
it. Okay. No. It's a long one, but it's great. But like, I remember taking my, let's go see Magnolia, dude. And it was just like fucking long. Yeah.
I thought beyond being long, there was one part of Funny People that messed with me where, I mean, I don't remember the details exactly, but I remember thinking, because I had been into comedy for a couple of years when that happened, enough to know that I was like, it's weird that this like huge comedy star is just like, oh, hey, young open micer who made me laugh once, you know, or like not open, but whatever level Seth Rogen was at was like pretty low.
Yeah, he was low.
Why don't you like write my act for me? Like, I just felt like it was like, what? Like, what? Like,
yeah.
It felt a little like this doesn't, maybe it's happened, but it doesn't, like, it's not like it's a very unusual setup for like that to be such a quick, like, yeah, sure. You're going to be my guy, like right away. And like, you're going to write for me. And like, he hadn't had any real, like, it's not like they had spent some months on the road, you know, like there was just no lead up to that. It was just like, oh, you're funny. Boom.
I guess it was just when he, like, because that was a scene where I think he gets up he comes back for the first time and he hadn't been around and he bombs, Adam Sandler bombs, and then Seth Rogen gets up there and talks shit about him. And, yeah, and then he can't get out, and he's like, hey, why don't you come, you know, you and that other guy. And he never had, what's his name? I forget, the curly-headed kid. He directed that, the 90s. Oh, fuck. I hate when I do this and I can't remember people's names. He was in Wolf of Wall Street with, he was Leo's buddy.
Oh, you're talking about, what's his name?
Jonah Hill. Yeah. It, you know, I guess, you know, he's like, nah, huh. I'm thinking, like, he's probably thinking, I'm sick, I'm dying or whatever. And this guy, oh, that guy's funny. He didn't, like, he's not sucking my dick, so I'll give him a shot, you know. But, and then there's certain things you account for it being a movie, you know.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, like certain happenstance and all that, you know. Oh, that's so convenient. So I told you about The Last of Us being my favorite game of all time. The new one, the new game, the part two is just like people are on the internet are just going ape shit over how they don't like it. And it's, oh, it's so convenient that this happened. Well, it's a script, dude. It's just like calm down a little bit. Yeah. But yeah, man. So where did you grew up in Massachusetts?
Yeah, I grew up in Massachusetts. I was born in Worcester. I grew up in the central Mass area.
What was that like?
It was good. Yeah. I don't have a dark, view of my childhood. Like it was pretty good. It was like, I feel like my upbringing was a lot of sports. It's just funny because, like, especially when you don't continue with that, like, you just, there's like this whole period of your life where, like, it feels like it was very sports heavy. For me to not do that anymore.
It was like that for me too. I mean, yeah. I grew up in Maryland, but I would say around 13, 14, it was over. When I got the freshman year of high school, it was over. I was like, I'm not as good as these kids.
I went through senior year doing that, and then at that point it was over. But yeah, it was a lot of that. And
what'd you play?
And like, I played football and basketball, and I did track too. Yeah, I did some pole vaulting. It was weird.
Oh wow.
It was weird at that point. Like they didn't have. I remember years later, I drove by a track meet at a high school, and it was like, they wear helmets now. And I remember thinking, when they pole vault, they wear helmets because it's actually a good idea because you can, crack your head open when you land on the ground if you miss the thing. Because you're like, 11 feet in the air.
Yeah.
You could be four, depends on how high you're going, but, you're 11 to 15 feet in the air. And then I remember thinking, we probably should have done that. That was a rule that probably happened when somebody broke their head.
Yeah.
I did a lot of like sports in high school. I remember my sense of being like, it's weird to me because I'm a very different person than I was then.
Mm.
And I think a lot of it is just like, it wasn't like a hard, like some people have had much like harder upbringings as far as like just everything.
Sure.
But one thing that did stick with me is like it's sort of like Massachusetts has a bit of an edge, a little like New York does,
mm-hmm.
where people are like, "Hey, fuck you." There's like that's kind of the vibe of like I remember that being around a lot, where like don't be soft or people will call you gay. Like it's just like mm-hmm. there's that thing of like. That vibe that I feel like is very like similar to New York, but I remember a lot of that growing up, just like kind of being like, oh yeah, okay, like I gotta kind of keep my guard up. And part of being an adult for me has been like letting some of that go.
What's the bit on your album when you talk about like trading your lunch and instead of
Yeah.
I mean, don't burn it.
If you were a boy and you cried, dudes would call you a bitch ass pussy and they take your snacks. That's probably the line you're thinking of.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. And I think there's some of that posturing that you do as a boy that you mm-hmm. learn. It's just kind of like learned behavior. Where you see your friends do it. I think my dad was he's a very stoic guy. He would talk to me and stuff, but he would hug me and shit like that because his dad wasn't around that much. Because his dad was in the service. So I got like love and stuff, but definitely he did want me to play football. Like he was really. Like he wanted it way more than I did.
Yeah.
And that's why the first comedy thing project I put out was called Failed Running Back. And it was definitely like you could tell he wanted it more. And then when I went to theater, he was just like, he still supported. But I think you know, before I left high school, he's like, you know, if you want the girls, I mean, sports, you know, and he was right. But there were girls in theater.
Yeah, I feel like, honestly, I'm not sure, you know, I feel like it's kind of even. You know, I don't remember. I mean, I guess I was young, but I don't really remember like sports being like, you may remember taking up a lot of time. And I don't remember like, you know, I don't remember that being a thing that's like, oh yeah, that's who the girl, like, I guess that's who girls like, but girls also like other people too. Like, it just seems like a nonsense thing that's been kind of like, it's a cultural thing.
Yeah. And I didn't start hooking up with girls till high school. I mean, till after high school.
Oh, okay.
And like really like, and then like dating people. And then when I moved to like a bigger city of Chicago, that's when it, like, you know, you start like meeting different people. But yeah, like that's definitely a thing though. I think just all boys in general will make you, look how you're an F, you're gay, you know, they think you're gay, or if you're not tough, or you listen to a certain type of music, you're not this, you're not that. And then you just get to a certain point where you're like, no, I know who I am. I'm good with this. I don't care.
Like, it took longer than I, like, in, like, looking back at it, I go, wow, I can't believe it took that long for me to be like, you know what? I'll have the cocktail that's pink. I like the way it tastes, like, you know, just to not care about that element was like, it took a lot of undoing. And it's also like, it's weird that we teach that, I guess, or embrace that, because it's so non-beneficial. Like, it's this thing that we think you got to be strong. Like, I mean, and I guess there is a route to power that's through sort of strength and, like, you know, puffing your chest out and doing some of that. But it does feel like there's also tremendous downside to that. And like, we don't really account for, like, there's this thing of like, I don't know, just people being like, listen, if somebody punches, you got to punch it back. It's like, there's this whole thing that I'm like, why are we like, as an adult, if you punch somebody, you go to jail. Like, there's, you
know what I mean? Right.
There's no room in the world really, like, you know, I mean, I guess it exists. It's out there and like, but it just doesn't seem like a good, like, it's not what I would teach a kid.
Yeah.
Or want a kid to be learning from other kids, like, at all.
Yeah, you just kind of want them to be, it's funny, like, Chris Rock was on, like, Neil Brennan's podcast, and I was watching it on YouTube while I was eating dinner, and Neil Brennan said something to me that I thought was pretty profound. He said, there's no good childhood until 1980. And I was born in 1980. Like, he's like, everything before that was pretty fucked up. And and then, like, 1980, you probably had some, there was like, things were different. Like, there was some variance. And I was just like, shit, man. I was like, well, I guess I had a pretty good childhood. There's some darkness, but I'd say overall it was pretty good. Like, I used to say before, I'm like, I was basically like the black Kevin Arnold from the Wonder Years. Like, it was just kind of normal suburban DC stuff.
Gotcha.
Maryland, DC area stuff. But yeah, that is something to think about, man. I remember one time when I first moved to Chicago, I was hanging out with this woman that I liked, and we were at a gay bar. Because I think the drinks were cheap or something. And eventually it would eventually be like right across the street from where I would live. Cause there's like Wrigleyville. I don't know if you're familiar with Chicago at all, but like where the,
a little bit. Yeah.
Yeah, where the Cubs stadium, like that Wrigleyville Lakeview area. It's like crazy frat boys. I don't know. This was like 15 years ago, but yeah, something like that. Jesus, over 50. Jesus Christ. Anyway.
I like this. This story is just making you realize like how old you are.
Yeah.
And you're just crumbling about it.
Yeah, it's just like, Jesus Christ, man. And so I'm hanging out with her and we're drinking. And she told, I think I had like is a Cosmo? What is cranberry and vodka? Is that Cosmo? That's a Cosmo,
no,
right?
No, that's just a vodka cranberry.
Yeah, vodka cranberry or something. And it was like a drinking it out of a martini glass or some shit. And she's like, you know, that's a gay drink, right? And I was like, is it really? So I just like, like scarfed it down. I mean, just not. And I was like, what? What is his name? You know, and she made fun of me.
Who was this girl that was acting like a real bro around you?
I don't know. She was. She just knew she could
drink that drink down. It's gay.
She knew that I liked her. I think looking back, like in hindsight, she knew that she could get to me. And she was just like, she was just more worldly than I was. Okay. And she was just kind of giving me shit. But she was bad. She was a bad one, man. She was hot. I have to tell you off mic how it led me to a pretty good moment in my comedy career. Okay. I'll tell you off mic because I don't want to, whatever. But just remind me to tell you off mic.
Yeah.
But she was a cool girl. We never really dated, but she was good people. That's an interesting thing. Like I think I don't know when I got secure with that. I would say I had a pretty good grasp of who I was before I left high school. So probably like junior year, you know.
Yeah.
Still had insecurities and stuff, but for the most part I was just like, this is pretty much who I am and who I'm going to be for the long haul.
Yeah.
You know, and you take your lumps and you grow and all that shit. So what was it like growing up there? Like, just was it, how far is that from Boston? Cause I've only,
it's like an hour out.
Okay. Cause I've been to Boston once to see Burr at the Wilbur. And
you pronounced that correctly. That's good.
And then I've done stuff in the Berkshires. I performed in the Berkshires a few times, and then like Williams College, like that's all that I know about, like the Williamstown Theater Festival.
Cool!
I love that. I fucking love it up there. But that's all that I know about New England. So it's just, did you go to school up there? Like, did you go to college?
I went to school in Maine. So you know, not like maybe like about 3 hours away.
Okay.
From where I grew up. You know, further north and then but I didn't really, like, as soon as I got out of college, I moved right to DC and I left the area.
Okay.
I never really like lived there as an adult.
Gotcha.
You know, I grew up in Massachusetts, went to college in Maine, and then I was out.
What school did you go to in Maine?
Colby College.
What kind of school is that?
It's like sort of similar to Williams.
A liberal arts?
It's like a small liberal arts school.
Gotcha.
Yeah.
And you went to would you go to DC for just work and stuff? Or?
You know, I got a job out of college, and they like were going to pay me, you know, what now I understand to be just like a very normal starting salary. But I was like, I'm going to be rich because, you know, I was, you know, I had been working like only landscaping to that point.
Yeah.
And I, you know, I crunched the numbers and I was like, I'm going to be rich in 5 years.
And then you realize you were in DC.
Yeah, I think then a lot of the realities of the world. I mean, I did save a lot of money because I was making a normal salary, and I still had the mindset of like a college kid.
Sure.
So my rent was like $500, and I was like, you know, living in a place without air conditioning. You know, I was saving as much as I could.
Right.
I got a job, and that kind of moved me down there. But I think in my head the whole time I did have, you know, I want to try comedy. And so I can remember looking into the comedy scene in DC before moving there when I got, you know, before when I was like looking for jobs and stuff and going like, oh, they have comedy there.
What year are we talking?
This would have been 2006, 2007 is when I started.
Okay. So you knew already that you...
I knew already, yeah.
Yeah,
I didn't know, you know, this is what I want. I knew I want to try.
Right. I think I always wanted to try, but I waited like a long ass time. Like I always, like my listeners know, I saw like somebody get booed at Showtime at the Apollo and just like, I was like, I'm not doing that shit.
Nice.
But I had all the like Martin Lawrence. I love Martin Lawrence because he was from the Maryland, DC area. Paul Mooney, Richard Pryor, Chappelle, like, you know, just loved all those people rock and would watch stand-up specials when I was a kid, but just was afraid to do it. And then moving here, wanting some artistic, like, some artistic endeavor to feed my soul, I started. But anyway, who cares about me? Yeah. I want to know about your journey. So, 07, you're down in DC and you start. Where'd you go up? What was the first?
There was a comedy club inside of a Best Western, in Tyson's Corner, Virginia.
Okay.
It was called Wiseacres.
Oh,
you've been there?
Never performed, but would hear Tim Miller and Andy and Randolph talk about it all the time.
So those guys, I mean, they were like the guys who were like already doing comedy when I started.
Yeah.
And they would be at that open mic too.
Okay.
So that was kind of like, that was the spot. And you know, it's funny, like in hindsight, the amount of people that were at that open mic who are now like having thriving, you know, like,
we talk about Rory career. Scovel, maybe.
Yeah. Rory, Aparna.
Yeah.
You know, like Jermaine Fowler, like, you know, mm-hmm. there was lots of people there, who I'm like, oh wow, that was actually a lot of talent in that weird little open mic. But
yeah.
But yeah, so I started there. And I remember, like, I didn't tell my friends about it, because I had the good sense to know that I would suck.
I shouldn't have did that. I should have took your, yeah.
A lot of people don't do that. And they're like, I invited everybody I knew to, and I'm like, no, man, I don't think I'm going to be good yet. You know, I kind of knew enough about comedy to know, like, you got to kind of like, it's a trial and error thing and you got to figure out. So, so I kept it secret for about 5 or 6 months. And I would like, it was hard because they're my roommates and they're like, where you go? Like, you know, when you're leaving the house and stuff. So I used to lie to them and make up all sorts of stories about where I was going. I used to like, you know, allegedly visit my aunt a lot, who I never visited that often. just stuff like that. Just, it had to be stuff that they didn't want to do, you know what I mean? Like, and I would go do that. It sort of started from there. And then eventually when I got like real work, doing it and I was like hosting it at shows, I started telling people and that. So, but it was basically like just a year out of college. So pretty much right away.
You guys didn't have any bringers though down there, did you?
No.
See, that's
the thing in DC. It's actually a great place to start because you don't have that. I every time I see how things are set up in New York, I go, ugh, what a terrible place to start comedy. But,
that's where I started. I started.
Yeah. I mean, I think it is compared mm-hmm. to other places.
It is. Yeah.
There's an open mic scene where you can actually not just like open mics have audiences.
Mm-hmm.
So you can get up at an open mic and you don't get a lot of time, but you're in front of a real audience. Whereas open mics in New York are all just comics, which is to me a terrible barometer for whether you're funny. And, and so you can do that. And then, you know, and then there's all these, the clubs, and there's a whole underground scene too. There's just so much room in DC to, if you're good, to grow. And that's why I think a lot of great comics come out of there, is because it's actually like set up quite well to do comedy.
It is. I would always tell like Lafayette and Courtney and those guys, I said, I envy you guys. Cause the mics, like I started doing the Green Room in the Draft House when that was still around, and that's what I started cutting my teeth there. But like in New York, I started at, it's no longer there, Comics I started there and New York Comedy Club, and like the open mic, like Sean Donnelly used to host it.
And I think I've been to that mic.
It was really, it was fun, but it was actually, I mean, it's still, I always say like doing that room was like practicing against the first team defense. Like you might get a laugh out of Mark Norman. You might say something funny. He's like, you know, or like Mike Lawrence would be there, and he would, you know, and like Andy Haynes, Dan St. Germain, like all those like downtown guys that they all those guys were like on their way to like, you know, where they are now, you know. So like they probably, I don't think they had gotten like TV spots yet, but they were like bubbling, you know.
Right.
So that's around the time and I start, and then I would go to DC and I'd do that green room open mic. I was like, this is like a fucking show in New York. This would be like the hottest show in the city.
Yes. There are literally shows in DC when I remember starting where I'm like, you know, after I had experienced both scenes, because, you know, when I came to New York, even though you've like, it's at that point I had done Montreal, nobody cares.
When did you do Montreal?
They're like, okay, cool. Here's where the mics are. And you're like, all right, I guess I'll start all over again.
So you did it out of DC. What year, who did you do Montreal with? New faces.
Joe List.
Okay.
Anthony DeVito, Nick Mullen, Annie Letterman. Was that, I mean,
yeah, what
I
year was that?
List all of them, but it was 2000 and I want to say 12. So I've been doing it for about 5 years at that point.
Gotcha. Gotcha.
But yeah, when I came to New York, so I saw both and I remember going back to DC going, yeah, like if this stupid show where like, you know, some of the comics are not even real comics, you know, it's like any scene, like there's bad, if this show where like horrible people can get up, and like if it had this audience, like, you know, I feel like big names would be dropping into this show in New York.
Yeah,
just
they would,
based on the amount of like consistent audience that it has. And here it's just this show with anonymous, you know, comics and sometimes people who stink.
Yeah.
And it's just such a contrast. But I did do that. I did start kind of again in New York. And I remember thinking, ugh, like, I mean, I was glad that I hadn't started there, like, for the very first. But also, you know, it's never great to be like, okay, here I am again at the bottom.
Yeah. It was good to get a good mix of both because, you know, my parents are down there and I would, you know, when I wasn't getting booked, you know, I would be, you know, going home and I would get booked there and, you know, Randolph and Andy would give me a good opportunity and stuff. Yeah. So like they were great. So then my self-esteem wasn't like totally trash when I would be doing these like shitty rooms or open mics and stuff. I was like, I know I can do the job and just always being prepared and like going to shows. I remember like a cool moment was when I would take the train from where I live in here in Jersey, take the train into the Port Authority. And then take it down to like by MSG and then come out and like Sean Donnelly was hosting this show. Oh fuck, I can't remember the name of it. It was somewhere, it was some room right by not far from UCB. And it was a basement bar show. And I was just going to watch. And he's like, "Hey man, how's it going?" I was like, "I've been doing pretty good. He's like, "You've been getting up?" I was like, "Yeah, yeah, yeah." And then like 10 minutes later, he was like, "Hey, somebody dropped out. Can you go up?" And I was like, yeah. And I went up and did, you know, did well. And that was like, you know, just like that Boy Scout shit. Always be prepared. I was never a Boy Scout, but I like that. I like that saying. And
it's you don't need to go through the whole Boy Scouts to get that saying. You can just Google it and then save yourselves, you know, a lot of like hiking trips. You know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah. And so it was just it was good to get that good mix. And then New York became like, well, like I can like it's sort of like I can do this. Did you ever were you ever intimidated by New York, or was it just more the rigmarole that you had to go through just to get on stage?
No, I was intimidated. Yeah. I mean, I think there's a lot of people, I get very socially intimidated by people who are like successful. I think, you know, I get in my head about like, you know, that element of it. So there were definitely moments at which, you know, you're in New York and there's all these great comics on it, you know, so it was definitely intimidating to me. Mm. And also I will say, it's not just, I don't go like, I have respect for New York in that the talent level is, I think, you know, incredible.
Yeah.
So I'm not one of these people that's like, oh, it's, you know, it's overrated. It's like, no, like I had trouble struggling because of like, just like to get on stage and stuff. I still recognize that, like, you know, there's so much talent in New York. And so often I'd be at a show where I'd be like, oh wow. Like, and it definitely upped my level of comedy too.
Yeah.
Because I think it's when I realized that some of the stuff I was doing before I got here was legitimately good. Mm-hmm. And then some of it was like, just sort of like parlor tricks. And you know what I mean? Like, yeah. Where it's like, oh, you know, New York won't let you get that laugh. You start to hear where the road laughs are, where you're like, oh, okay. And you see, you know, so I think I got better from being in New York, from that. So it definitely intimidated me, you know, at many points.
I think I got frustrated a lot just like trying to get time in clubs, like the bringer system. 'Cause I was in, like, kind of did some without knowing that I was doing them. I remember waiting at New York Comedy Club. Like the first time I went, I told people from my office and they came and I actually did pretty good. Like it was fine. Like, you know, yeah. It was just like looking back, it's like, ugh. But then, you know, at the time it was like, I'm fucking killing. Yeah. And then the next time I did it, there I didn't have anybody and I just didn't get put up. And I was like, what the fuck? And I was like, I got to do something different. And I just kept doing like the Ochi's Lounge. And then when comics went away, like I always say that that's like the time, I think maybe 2000, maybe like 11 or 12, I think when it went away, I'm not 100% sure, but I think I was maybe 2 or 3 years in before when that club just closed and it was like a wasteland. Like it was kind of like another, like, I don't know. It was just like a rebirth of another thing. Like, 'cause there was kind of nothing. It was like the Wild Wild West. Yeah. There was no home for like these downtown alt comics. Yeah. And so then it became something else. And, you know, it was different. Like, and I guess we'll fucking go through that again. You know, now we'll have to. But even before the pandemic, it was just like it was a different type of scene. And, you know, and then I kind of just like after I did a little bit of road with Chris Hardwick, and that was because of Randolph and Andy. Like I emceed for him in 2011 and then just kind of kept in touch and did some stuff. But and then that's when you kind of realize like, oh, you kind of like. Oh, I can, these jokes that I did in this basement work in Philly or they work in like San Francisco or whatever. And so then I just kind of had that confidence and stuff. But for you, what was it like when you kind of felt like you got your feet on the ground, like here, like where you got your footing and you were able to, you know, really make things work for you?
I mean, I guess it hit, I kind of felt like at some point, like it hit where I was at least just like getting booked regular. Like to me, it was like, it took a while to just get on stage and that was very frustrating for me because I already knew I could do it at that point.
Yeah.
You know, I had already, you know, I had been sort of, you know, when you're like, when you can, you know, headline shows, out of, you know, outside of DC or whatever, you it's difficult to like swallow that. Yeah. So at some point, once I started getting on stage a lot, I felt like, okay, like that's all I really need. Like once I got that going, the rest of it I can kind of deal with. But to be honest with you, like, New York feels like a constant, thing. I don't know that I've ever, and this might be a good thing. I don't know that I've ever felt like, ah, I'm where I want to be here. Like,
oh, sure.
It always feels to me like I want to do more and like I could be doing more. And, you know, and I'm always kind of like, I mean, the bad part is I'm always kind of feeling like, you know, oh, I gotta get like, you know, there's more I could do. So to me, that's one great thing about New York is in other cities, you get comfortable.
Yeah.
You know, like when I was in DC, at some point I'm like, okay, but short of being sort of, I don't know, getting a TV credit down here somehow, you know, and being able to like headline the A clubs.
Sure.
In some way. Like, you know, if you're featuring at the A clubs and you're doing everything else and you're, you know, writing new, like you're doing everything you can do, you kind of topped out. So I felt like, you know, okay, now I should go somewhere else. And the cool thing about New York and also a terrible thing about New York is that you never get to feel like that.
Hmm.
I mean, I don't at least ever feel like, oh, now I'm here and I'm established and I'm good. Like, you know, because there's so much in New York that you're not doing. I mean, there's so much talent around you and there's so much, you know, to still accomplish that I don't think you'd ever feel that way here. So that's, I think it's a good thing. It's probably not a great thing for my mental health, but it's a good thing for my comedy growth.
that is interesting though, because you kind of think about that. Like you think like, well, there's always somebody doing way better than you or X, Y, Z. And I remember I would go to those blacklist tapings. Like, I saw John Mulaney tape New in Town. I saw Wyatt Cenac tape, Comedy Person. And then I saw Patrice do Elephant in the Room. You worked with him, right?
Yeah.
What was it like?
He did not like me.
Did he make fun of you? Because if he made fun of you, I think he liked you.
Yeah, that was what his feature act told me, and I felt like I didn't believe him, or at least it was like, if this is what how he treats people who like him, then I don't understand
this man. I think he liked you, man.
Yeah, I mean he just dogged at me the whole weekend, and the feature act did say that. He said, hey, listen, you know, like it means he likes you. If he didn't like you, he wouldn't make fun of you. And I'm like, okay,
yeah, that's true.
I don't think I'd ever gotten it that hard from anybody.
And you're both Massachusetts guys.
Yeah, I mean, you know, he wasn't, I don't know if he even knew that. He wasn't.
Oh, you didn't know.
Well, I mean, he wasn't really like, hey, like, let me get to know you.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? He had a way of like holding courts and talking, and you just kind of listened. And I knew enough to not like, you know.
Sure.
I don't know. I knew my place.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
But then I remember one time like there was one show, he would ask me how the audience was when I got him. So I'm like, okay, well, I guess I answer, you know. So one show, I come on stage and he goes, it felt like a hotter crowd than the previous two or whatever we were doing the weekend. And he goes, so how's the audience out there? And I was like, I think maybe this is the, best one so far. And he just goes, man, you don't know what the fuck you're talking about. he was just kind of brutal.
I would have loved that. I would have laughed, man. You're so fucking lucky you got to work with him.
Well, yeah.
You didn't think that at the time, though.
No, at the time, I just thought, this man is so, he hates me so much, and I wish that he liked me. Do you know what I mean? And I remember at the end of the night, the only time that he gave me, so like at the time I was dating or seeing a girl who was, I think, like quite attractive.
Okay.
And she had come out to one of the shows. After the show, you know, we're getting like, he was doing his pictures thing out in the lobby, whatever. And, she was got a picture with him and then with me, and it became clear to him that he goes, is this your girl? He goes, oh man. He said something like, this is the only thing I don't hate about you. So just something like that.
Dude, come on. See, I'm asking you this because I think one time Patrice came up and Randolph always tells a story about when J.L. Covan emceed for Patrice and Patrice dogged him like in front of everybody, you know, like holding court, like you said. And he's like, yeah, you know, he did the same to Brian Parisi, but Brian didn't get it. He's like, oh, he's making fun of me.
Yeah. I mean, I can't, it's like, it was a thing where I'm like, in the feature had told me like, it's, you know, don't worry. But like, I don't know if I'm equipped to like communicate with that. Like, it's just, you know,
yeah.
That thing of like, also like it seems a little bit like not that I would like be able to go toe to toe with Patrice. Right.
Right.
But it's like, you can't even, what are you going to throw a punch at the headliner?
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Yeah. Like, I didn't feel like in a position to be like, oh yeah, well fuck you, you fat piece of shit. You know, like, what am I going to do?
Yeah.
You know,
I'm trying to think who did that to me. I mean, there are comics that make fun, people that, well, there's certain, I have certain friends that do like comics that have been doing it way longer and they'll, you know, talk shit to me but they, one of them just kind of become a friend, like a big brother in the game, you know? But yeah, like for the most part, everybody's pretty chill, but like a guy, I think he could come across as acerbic, but I think like doing stand up, I think I've just noticed that a lot more where that's that man shit. That's that
thing. Old school
stuff where if they
But I mean, he did, like, my other takeaway from the weekend is that like wow. Like, cause he was, you know, sometimes you watch a headliner once if you're opening for him and, you know, and every act is kind of the same and you kind of go like, all right, well, like, and you might watch the rest of it. You know, I like to watch a lot. So I'll watch it if it's repetitive.
Yeah.
But you know, you're not quite enjoying it. You're like, you're like studying it.
Yes.
Him, yeah. I felt like every show was, even though he had, you know, obviously some of the same stuff, every show was different and unique. And he was such an incredible, presence that I felt like every single show was worth watching. And I watched probably six or eight, you know, which is wild to me. That's one of the only times I've actually felt like that. He was an incredible talent. And I felt that was my two takeaways was he is an incredible talent who does not like me as a person. But you know, I did hear the other side of that it means he likes you, but I don't know. It didn't feel that way.
Yeah. It's funny because I'm a sensitive dude like that too. Yeah. And I can definitely some of those things can definitely stick, but then at the same time, it's like, I think maybe that guy, like, because if he didn't, he wouldn't have said shit. Yeah. You know, he wouldn't have said anything to you. But that's funny, man. Talk a little bit about your journey writing on television, and then I want to wrap it up with you with just talking about the album for a bit. How did involved with John Oliver's show?
Just writing packets.
Okay.
You know, and I had been doing that for a little while before I got that job. And, you know, at the time, it's a little bit easier now because I have a manager and an agent. And, like, when there's a show hiring, I am, you know, I find out about it through them.
Right.
Whereas when I got the show at Oliver, I was just, you know, doing this thing of, like, trying to hear from other people.
Mm-hmm.
who had it. So you're just, it's just very like, you know, I was a bottom feeder, like if little bits of information trickled down from people who, you know, that's when I would get, by the way, for anybody who's getting it that way right now, bottom feeder, I didn't mean that as a derogatory term,
can you speak to this? Cause like sometimes you'd have friends that would quote unquote friends, they would tell you about a writing job, but you only had, it's like this writing job for Amy Schumer, but it's due in 2 hours.
Yeah. Oh yeah. That always
like,
happens.
It's like, fuck you.
Yeah. I mean, that happens. I also would have situations where I would hear about it, but have no way to submit to it.
Mm-hmm.
So I would just like send an unsolicited email to a thing and know that like, there's a good chance that they just go, oh, this guy's not on the list and throw in the trash. So
yeah,
you know, that was happening. So it, you know, it's not great, but I broke through into the pile.
That's great.
And then got hired for that gig, and you know, and then I've written more recently for Patriot Act with Hasan Minhaj.
But don't gloss over it. You're an Emmy winner, right?
Yeah. Sure. It's like, to me though, it's funny. Like people, I think other people focus on that. And I get it.
What do your parents think? They must think that's pretty cool, right?
Yeah, totally. I mean, I think everybody who, and not that I don't think it's cool, but just the thing to me that's like, when people are like, oh, they associate that right away. They go like, oh, you know, you wrote for Late Night Show, you won an Emmy. It's like, yeah. But the bigger thing for me was I quit my job. So to that point, you know, I'm about almost 10 years into comedy. Right. And I get this gig and I had always had a day job.
Yeah.
My entire post, you know, from college until then. And for the first time, I got to quit my job and do comedy full time. So
sure.
To me, that's what late night writing has done for me, is it's given me a chance at doing comedy without, you know, spending 40 hours a week or 50 hours a week or whatever.
Oh, my
doing
God.
Something
yeah.
else. And so that's been the biggest thing about the late night writing thing. You know, like
sure.
like the Emmy thing is cool and whatever, but it's like, it's really, it's that. It's like the reality of what it does for you is it takes you from somebody who has no chance at making enough money to live in New York doing stand-up and changes you from somebody who can do just stand-up and another comedy thing and do them full-time. So since then, I've been able to do comedy full-time, which for me has been kind of the big thing.
Yeah, that's a big deal. Like, I think making it to me is similar, like just not having to work a day job. Yeah, that's great, man.
Yeah.
Well, let's talk
about... I never disliked, to be honest with you, like, there were day jobs that I actually had, and like, I'll get into whatever I'm doing, you know what I mean?
So sure.
I wasn't sitting there, like, twiddling my... I was working and sometimes enjoying it, but it was just, you know, the chance to get to do... to put the amount of energy that I really want to put into comedy is what was so cool.
Right. Right. That's great, man. And you were working with, Hasan Minhaj with his show, Patriot Act.
Yep. Yeah. So that was, this year we started, it was a weird experience on the show because when I started, we were in the studio,
mm-hmm.
you know, like writing, and we filmed one episode before coronavirus happened.
Mm.
So my experience at Patriot Act has been taking a show. When we started, we had the show the way it was. And then we ended up through a series of different things. We got sort of put on hold or, you know, laid off for a bit while they figured out how to do the show remotely. And then we came back on. And then there was some, like, it was this sort of trying to figure out how we're going to make the show in front of a green screen with no people and no crew and still have it work. So it was very, it was a weird, you know, a much weirder experience on the show than I think probably most people had, because it was just that, like, transition to, oh, we're going to do the show without an audience now.
Mm.
And so it just changed a lot. Within this year that I've been doing it. So
one other writing for TV question, what was it like for you to make the transition from writing mostly about yourself to like writing for someone else's voice? Like, you know, like a John Oliver.
I think it's challenging. And you know, like your idea of what the voice of a show is can be like, you know, it's a little bit of a guess, right?
Mm-hmm.
And you can kind of, because the thing is you don't like, it's a thing between, do I mimic exactly what's happening and do the same exact thing? Or do I, you know, because you, when you're coming up with comedy, like it comes somewhat from your sensibility and from your mind.
Right.
So it's about trying to like, have your like authentic organic humor be able to be put in that, but it's a challenge for sure. And I think the only way you get there is from just like reps of doing it. A lot of people who will ask me about, like, you know, people who are writing packets and sometimes, like, you know, not having success at it. You know, part of it I think is just like practicing. So when people are like, well, I feel like I'm wasting my time writing these packets. It's like, you're not wasting, you're practicing the thing that you would need to do every day. And if you've only done it like once or twice for a packet, like you're not going to be ready. So I, you know, in some ways I feel like, you know, it was hard to be ready like for the job because just the sheer volume of it. You know, as a stand-up, there's no way you're writing the volume of comedy that you're having to write for these shows. So, you know, it's one thing to, okay, I'll come up with a joke about this and I'll workshop it for a couple of weeks. And it's like, no, come up with 5 jokes about this particular prompt and do it today. And that is a whole different muscle. And so it's, you know, that's a challenge. But, you know, writing for different people's voices is definitely like a big, big obstacle. Luckily, like I'm not someone who relies on like personality. it sounds like I'm saying I don't have a good personality. That might be true. I don't know. But I am a joke person. So at least I got that where you know, I write jokes about different topics sometimes, and I'm not doing like late night style humor in my stand up, but I'm also not up there just relying on being charming. Because, you know, there is that. And it's not a bad thing. Like, some people kind of rely on like personal stories and, you know, and who they are. And I think actually those people probably succeed more often than people who are sort of more joke based. But luckily I had that experience, which I think helps with like late night writing.
Has it helped your stand up?
Oh yeah. Yeah.
In what ways? I mean, like
it's,
just being versatile and malleable to the situations or.
Yeah. I mean, I think the volume helped because I would go, oh, like I used to think, oh, once I get a laugh on this line, like once I get a laugh, if I get a laugh on this part, like, okay, that part works.
Yeah.
I was thinking of it in terms of like, you know, I think I was stopping short of, I was always tinkering with my jokes, but I think what I, the process of writing like alternative jokes for each part of going, okay, let's write on this detail, what are four different jokes on this? And because often in these shows, you'll pitch four different jokes for the same prompt or two or three different jokes for the same prompt. And that process got me to go, oh, like, you know, let me think of each joke. Let me think of each part of a joke as something that could be itself, you know, we call it alting in late night writing, but, you know, that could have a different part, like a different, you know, version of this. So I think that helped. And just the way I think about jokes is a little bit more, I think I have a better perspective on how to edit and edit jokes and when jokes are like, oh, this is too basic. Like this is too obvious. I think my alarm for that is a lot higher.
Yeah.
Where I'm like, that's not, you know, that's not going to be unique enough. So I think the combination of those things made it much, a much better writer for my stand up from doing that.
Yeah. I forgot to ask you this before we started, like before in the beginning, where did we meet? Do you remember?
I don't know. I'm trying to think. I honestly wouldn't be surprised if we met back when you were coming down to DC.
Okay.
To do the Green Room. Like the first time,
yeah.
You know, it was probably like a sort of a passing thing, but I think I remember you from that.
Okay.
Cause I would have been in DC when you were up here and coming down there, I think. So yeah, it was probably that.
Cause I know I did your show right after the election.
Yeah. Yeah.
And yeah, that was interesting. That was an interesting night.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I want to shift gears and talk about this album, Last Wishes. I really liked it, man. Randolph, when you were on Three Guys On, was talking about the precision in your writing, and you definitely have that shit, dude. There's no fat. It's just like, it's very like laser sharp.
Thank you.
And it's like, yeah, it's really good. Like, I really appreciate that. Like, the jokes are good, but I just really appreciate the technical aspect of the way that you write, and then the way that you present it too. Because like, it's just like out of the gate, you're like, we're talking about death for about 7 or 8 minutes. Why start that way? Do you have a fascination with death?
I mean, I guess I have some fascination with it. Definitely something I think about a lot. Mm-hmm. I think I'm sort of afraid of it, and so I talk about it as you know. But I mean, I've definitely asked myself the question, why start the album that way? going into the recording, I'm like, should I start the album this way? You know, there's some school of thought that it might not have been a good idea.
It works for me. I'm just asking.
No, I know. I think it did work too. It's funny because it's sort of something that I thought, maybe I should start a little lighter. And then I just thought like, you know what? No, like this is, I end up talking about a lot of dark things in a blunt way,
mm-hmm.
you know, like, and I'm not gonna, like, you know, hey, is everybody drinking my way into my album? Like, it's just like, you know what I mean? Like, this yeah. is the album, like, this is the jokes. And I know I'm going to be doing a long bit about my own funeral and kind of, you know, to turn out naming the album, you know, in that way. So I just thought, like, let's just get into it. But I think I definitely, like, I talk about, I don't like the way that we avoid talking about death as like a polite thing.
Mm-hmm.
And so this is sort of my, you know, my response, like against that is just like, I'm just going to talk about it. And like, you know, if somebody's had someone who died and they feel like this hits in a, like, I'm sorry, like, that's not my intention. But it's just like, I'm going to talk about it like the way that I think about it in my twisted anxiety mind, and so that's kind of where it comes from.
Yeah, it's, I liked it. I mean, it's because it's definitely, it's stuff I think about all the time. You think about your own death, the
yeah.
death of your parents, and if things go a certain way, you think, you know, it's them before you, but nobody has control yeah. over that. And then what kind of person would you be after that, you know? Like, I think about that all the time. I think it's actually healthy to talk about that stuff, like, as a comic, to talk about, you know, as an artist, to talk about what you're afraid of. Yeah. You know, that,
and I think, like, I mean, I, like, I recorded this you know, literally the week before the pandemic.
Okay.
I didn't know that you know, that death would be kind of a more relevant than we'd like topic,
mm-hmm.
you know, going into it. But like, yeah, it's definitely something that I feel like, I just notice, sometimes I notice after I'm done creating material, like, I'm just talking about the things that I find funny that I want to talk about. And I'm like, oh, yo, I have like almost 10 minutes on just death related things.
Yeah.
I guess I'll put them all in the same place, you know?
Sure. Yeah.
It kind of like just happens that way.
Where'd you record this?
The Big Hunt.
Sure,
in
yeah.
DC. So it's like this packed little basement where, in hindsight, COVID was probably already there. Nobody got sick afterwards. I hadn't heard anything like that. So,
yeah.
you know, I'm sort of kidding about it a little bit. But
it's
like,
such a great room for comedy.
It's an awesome room for comedy.
Yeah.
It is not a room that, like, you would, you know, there was no space in there. It is a packed basement with zero airflow. So I am super lucky that, that it was sort of the week before things started, like, 'cause they gave me a couple of dates, and if I had just picked it, honestly, a week later, this wouldn't have happened. You know, like things would have shut down. So I'm honestly just super lucky and grateful that, like, this came together at all.
Yeah. I talked to, Carmen Lynch, a few months ago, and she recorded hers in Indiana. And she was saying that, you know, I mean, she actually has jokes about COVID in her album. And, you know, like, it was another, you know, taping right before
yeah.
shit went bad. I mean, I remember, and then I saw it, like, right before everything shut down, I went to Sarah Tolomash's, and I don't think she mentions it in hers, but
yeah.
it was definitely one of those, like, you're the third person that's been on the show that got it in under the wire, where mine was just like a reaction of wanting something with a barcode on it before I died, and cobbling together some stuff, you know.
Yeah.
And then, you know, but, and then when we get back, hopefully I can do a full length and blah 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 and all that shit. But yeah, man, this is really good. Like, I like how you have, like, you are a joke guy, but I think a taste thing for me is you do bring yourself to it as well. You know, like, you're
yeah.
talking about, you know, we get glimpse, like, my, I think probably, God, I don't know what track that is, but where you do mention that line about, you know, having the not crying, and,
yeah.
and you're talking about immigrants, and then you're talking about your dad. it's some really good shit in there, man.
Thanks.
Yeah, you should be proud of it, man. So where can people find this? When is this coming out?
Let me ask you this. When does this recording, goes up soon? Yeah.
I'll probably put this up. This is Halloween. If I don't put it up today, tonight, it'll go up on November 1st.
Okay. So yeah, if it's, so the album actually comes out, and is available on Election Day.
Okay.
So that's when it'll drop, but it'll be, if anyone's listening to this before Election Day, it's available for pre-order on iTunes and Amazon Music. And basically, if you go to my social media or my website or anything, the link is there. My last name is Parise. If you look for P-A-R-I-S-E, and you put that in any of the social medias, you'll find me. So
that's great, man. Well, Brian, hold on to the line, and this has been awesome, man. I'm glad we got to do this. Everybody go get Last Wishes by the great Brian Parise. Put your money down. I'm sure it's a reasonable price.
It's for the I think it's $9.99.
The price of two coffees, I guess, at Starbucks. I don't know. I don't drink coffee, but it's good, man. Support, stream it, buy it. Download it, whatever you need to do. Thank you so much, Brian, for stopping by the show.
And yeah, man, thanks for having me.
And we'll talk to you next time. Take it easy, everybody.